To my dearest friends, I am honored to welcome you back once more as we continue our investigations into the fabled tyrannic wars that have undeniably reshaped the course of galactic history. In the wake of Hive Fleet Behemoth's onslaught, one might have hoped that humanity's nightmare had ended at Macragge, with the heroic sacrifice of the Ultramarines' first company marking the final defeat of those intergalactic predators. But alas, beyond the light of our most distant stars, the unimaginable hunger of the alien only swelled larger. The swarm, newly identified as the Tyranids, was to remain as an endless tide, being a mass of innumerable monstrosities bound to the single unfathomable will of the hive mind. Of all the threats the galaxy has ever faced, none can quite compare to the sheer magnitude of the Tyranid menace, and none have ever possessed a hunger so insatiable that they might one day devour the very stars themselves. When their kind first probed our worlds, we discovered that humanity was woefully unprepared for the scale of horror bearing down upon them. The first tyrannic war, launched by Hive Fleet Behemoth, ravaged the southeastern fringe and was only defeated thanks to the efforts of the Ultramarines, who were prepared to die before ever surrendering their homeworld to total consumption. But the stars subjected to the Tyranid approach had been forever changed. Entire systems now lay as barren husks, stripped of all life by the invaders, with the Imperium left reeling in the wake of these alien beasts. Behemoth had been defeated, yes, but it had not been the sum total of the Tyranid race, as some foolhardy souls dared to hope. The dark shadow of the Tyranids had only been pushed back into the vacuum of intergalactic space, and over the following years, humanity's vigilance would falter, with many leaders convincing themselves that Behemoth had been but an aberration, that it was a lone monster, slain for good. But they could not possibly imagine that a second and even more cunning horror was already coiling itself to strike anew. And so, my dearest friends, we turn now to the period of uneasy recovery that followed the first invasion. We will see how the Imperium girded its fragile worlds against further terror, even as dissent and heresy began to take root. We shall then witness how the galaxy's brief respite was shattered by the reemergence of the Great Devourer in a new and most terrible form, and of how it exploited the apparent strengths of the Imperium, all for its own gain. But I have spoken enough. And so, my dearest friends, I do believe that it is now time for us to begin. This is to be a tale of devastation beyond anything once thought possible, as we must now learn of the first documented accounts of Hive Fleet Kraken and of the Second Tyrannic War. It was the year 751 of the 41st millennium, and the southeastern reaches of the galaxy lay in ruin. Hive Fleet Behemoth had been defeated by the Ultramarines, but untold billions of innocents had died, and countless worlds now hung in cold desolation, with every last trace of life having been stripped and devoured by the Hive. The realm of Ultramar itself had nearly collapsed under the weight of the Tyranid invasion, being saved only at the incalculable cost of the entire First Company. But in response, The Imperium established a prodigious armed presence across the vulnerable frontier, setting up numerous outposts, orbital strongholds, and stellar ports, hoping to protect their distant sectors against any further Xenos incursion. Yet, as the decades passed, it seemed as though the Imperial Lords were all too quick to forget their own history. Debates raged within the Administratum over the necessity of this costly vigilance, claiming that the Imperial armies were stretched too thin across the galaxy to be wasted in this forgotten graveyard. Senior lords, who never actually fought the Tyranids themselves, boldly asserted that the species had been utterly destroyed and that the behemoth was but a rare phenomenon which would never again endanger the many worlds of the Imperium. Others, however, were not so certain. Among the wary were the Inquisitors, primarily hailing from the Ordo Xenos, who remembered all too well the chilling reports from Cryptman's expedition upon Tyran, that first dead world, and of the terrible shadow in the warp that quietly presaged Behemoth's arrival. Could one truly know that every Tyranid had perished at Macragge? What if the Hive Fleet had merely been driven back, or if it was but a tendril severed from some greater whole lurking beyond the stars? Tension between the factions continued to mount, but further forces were continuously redeployed to the eastern garrisons, slowly reshaping Imperial planets into fortress worlds and fair rule into martial law. Worlds that had survived Behemoth's onslaught struggled to rebuild their industries and to feed their people, whilst also taking on the heavy burdens of increased tithes and mandatory fortifications. This went on for around 2.5 centuries, and though their planets were now undeniably safe from an external invasion, the Imperium perhaps never expected for a new danger to emerge from within. Several far-flung colonial planets erupted in open rebellion, with bombings, riots, and violent uprisings breaking out on worlds that had, until then, always been compliant. Local lords obviously labeled these as acts of unwarranted terror, but the citizens themselves claimed that they had to put an end to their oppression and had to find some way of breaking their interminable maltreatment. They were sick of their homes being governed as though they were in a war zone, and of being treated as second-class citizens to the masses of guardsmen now patrolling their streets. All things considered, their outlashes seemed quite reasonable. But the Inquisition, upon investigating such events, noticed a most troubling pattern. The adepts and demagogues fanning the flames of discontent all shared one subtle commonality. They each held some connection to the dead worlds of the southeastern fringe. Some of the seditious leaders had been born in that now desolate frontier, while others, far more suspiciously, had journeyed there in very recent years, seeking to behold the graveyard of the Behemoth for some inexplicable reason. This may sound quite meaningless, after all. Their planets were relatively close to that region, and maybe they had valid cause to their travels. But we must remember that to the Inquisition, there is no such thing as a coincidence. Inquisitorial agents promptly moved to warn Terra that the rebellions might not be born of simple human discontent, but of some lingering corruption that burrowed unseen across the populace. Acting with their characteristically decisive ruthlessness, the Inquisition undertook a massive purge across the Eastern Fringe, removing tens of thousands of prominent individuals from their posts before subjecting them to brutal interrogations. They believed that maybe some form of deranged cult had pervaded their worlds, and that if the threat was not contained, then it could spell the downfall of the entire frontier. With that in mind, their purges, though brutal, did indeed restore the tense feeling of order. The suspected officials had been dealt with, though, in truth, the Inquisitors could not help but feel uneasy at having not identified the ultimate source to this corruption. They believed that something must be out there, that there had to be some reason behind the madness. But the answer, as the Imperium would soon learn, was more terrifying than anyone dared to imagine. Nearly 250 standard Terran years after the conclusion of the First Tyrannic War, a most terrible pattern began to repeat itself. Around the year 990 of the 41st millennium, far out on the eastern fringe, in those remote sectors where the Astronomicon's guiding light grows dim, entire planetary systems started to fall silent. One by one, Imperial frontier worlds simply ceased in their regular communications, no longer even pinging back Vox requests, almost like the planets had vanished from reality. At first, the losses were sporadic, a minor settlement here, a mining outpost there, but soon, whole clusters of stars started disappearing in an ominous quiet. With the recent rebellious outbreaks fresh in their minds, most Imperial commanders dismissed the silence as evidence of a renewed insurrection and assumed the malcontent colonies had simply severed all contact to hide their sedition. Yet, if that were so, it would be unlike any rebellion ever seen, as they did not broadcast their grand manifestos of defiance, nor Vox messages proclaiming their independence. There weren't even any calls for aid from the Imperial Guard forces. So, what really happened? Among the Ordo Xenos, a few inquisitive minds voiced their uncomfortable hypothesis that this could very well be the work of another Tyranid hive fleet. But their suggestion, outlandish and baseless, was met by scorn by those who recalled Behemoth's notably different pattern of attack. The First Fleet had been a relentless battering ram that came crashing through the void as a single, overwhelming spear, plunging hard and fast into the soft underbelly of Imperial space. Its initial onslaught had been highly concentrated, whereas in this case, the disappearances were scattered across a far wider region, with dozens of worlds blinking out near simultaneously, despite being separated by light years of distance. This couldn't be the Tyranids. What a ridiculous idea that would be, they claimed, insisting instead that it had to be something else, maybe a coordinated rebellion or some massive warp storm, or maybe even a new alien species, but certainly not the Tyranids. But the Emperor's loyal agents had not forgotten the nature of their foe. Those who studied the First Tyrannic War recognized a gnawing familiarity in these events, with astropaths reporting a growing psychic darkness over the frontier of long-ranged Auspex scans, revealing naught but shadow, and of an unnatural anxiety spreading across the fringe. But while the Inquisitors debated and argued, the Imperial worlds in the East had discovered their answer. By the time any warning could be sent, it was far too late, and the truth could no longer be denied. The Tyranids had returned, having sunk their claws into the galaxy once more, and it was already feasting. Though still obscured behind the shadow in the warp, The hive fleet had stretched itself wide, arriving as a multitude of smaller swarms striking in unison, and like the coils of a gigantic cephalopod closing around its prey, those many tendrils snared entire sectors in a web of shadow and death. Worlds fell by the dozen, succumbing to the ravenous swarm far faster than in the case of the behemoth. Of course, the wider Imperium had no idea this was occurring. They simply recorded that an entire sector's worth of territory had been silenced almost overnight, while still deliberating over the potential cause. In those crucial early months of the Tyranid return, before the new fleet had even been given a name, dozens of colonies were wiped out, with mankind not even realizing that a war had begun. But before they finally put the pieces together and saw what was really happening, the Inquisition was forced to address a most heinous problem growing within the heart of the Eastern Fringe. Regardless of the sudden loss of contact with the worlds of the Imperial East, the Inquisition was still wrestling with the unprecedented wave of rebellions across the frontier, and though they had indeed purged many suspicious demagogues, it did not seem to be a problem with such a simple solution. Foremost among them, however, was the catastrophic rebellion on the vital hive world of Ikar IV. This planet was a linchpin to the Imperium's presence within the Eastern Fringe, being located at the heart of a bustling sector, connecting dozens of worlds through safe shipping lanes, while supplying them with its ceaseless industrial output. Such a world could under no circumstances be allowed to fall, and yet even the mightiest lion may crumble if it rots from within. Almost overnight, a curious religious cult had emerged within the hives, naming themselves as the Brotherhood, where they preached of the God Emperor's imminent return, and that he would soon walk among them, ushering in a new golden age for all mankind. This hopeful creed struck an immediate chord with the downtrodden workers of Ikar IV's crowded cities. They toiled in endless shifts beneath the oppressive martial laws, with very little to look forward to, but the Brotherhood offered them divine deliverance with the clear promise of glory should they join hands in faith. Naturally, the movement spread like wildfire. Brotherhood missionaries set up chapels in the underhives and industrial slums, swearing that one day liberation and a better future would soon come. The ecclesiarchy, wary of any new creed, scrutinized the Brotherhood's teachings, but found no obvious signs of heresy. The acolytes spoke only of the Emperor, albeit in a strangely literal sense, and encouraged both industry and hope amidst a populace who were expected to work and die without complaint. Thus, with caution, the ecclesiarchy legitimized their sect and granted permission for the Brotherhood to construct a grand cathedral in Ikar IV's capital hive. But this decision, in hindsight, would soon prove to carry grave consequences. Once entrenched, the Brotherhood rapidly escalated its operations, spreading out in an increasingly militant and uncompromising fashion. Their preachers whipped the crowds into fanatics, urging them to cast off any who would not accept the coming of the Emperor Reborn. They then refused to render the planet's scheduled tithes to the Imperium, declaring that their faith took precedence over bureaucratic demands. When the planetary governor attempted to enforce compliance, the Brotherhood became openly defiant, spurring mobs of their followers to roam the streets, attacking any officials, and punishing all unbelievers in brutal displays of public violence. It did not take long for tensions to break into all-out rebellion after a group of Adeptus Arbites enforcers sought to disperse a gathering, and as soon as the first drops of blood were spilled, the Brotherhood cast aside their facade of peaceful faith and sparked a civil war. The world fell into chaos, with the faithful within the Planetary Defense Forces rising up to overthrow the loyalist guardsmen, seizing hab after hab, while tanks trundled down the main promenade, besieging Arbite strongholds, who all fell before the onslaught of the cult. The planetary governor was assassinated amid the anarchy, with his palace overrun, and his ministers butchered before roaring crowds. In a matter of solar days, Icar IV had fallen, with the Brotherhood declaring themselves as independent from the Imperium, as a theocratic state awaiting the coming of their four-armed emperor. The Imperial response was swift, but ultimately insufficient. With Icar IV's own forces compromised, reinforcements were needed from off-world. But the nearest aid came in the form of an inquisitor of the Ordo Xenos, one Agmar, who made his clandestine arrival 27 days after the rebellion's outbreak. Agmar immediately suspected that something far more sinister lurked beneath this uprising. The organization, scale, and fervor of the Brotherhood was uncanny. It was simply too coordinated to be labeled as a workers' revolt. Thus, he slipped into the hive and with his retinue set out to discover the truth. For weeks, he moved through the war-torn city, gathering intelligence amid skirmishes between the cult and the remaining loyalists, noting how the Brotherhood fought with an unnatural ferocity, sometimes bordering on the feral, and sometimes seeming rather alien. He witnessed hunched and deformed figures loping amidst the shadows, but it was only when he singled one of them out and sank his blade deeply into its neck that he made his terrible revelation. The dying preacher did not bleed as a man, but oozed ichor from flesh warped by alien biology. Its clawed limbs and chitinous growths were concealed beneath heavy robes, but this was no ordinary heretic. It was a gene-stealer hybrid, a human tyrannid aberration spawned by the Great Devourer. It was now clear to see that the Brotherhood was a gene-stealer cult, its followers feigning in their beliefs as they served the domineering will of the secretive patriarch. Agmar understood with a dawning horror that the rebellions of the Eastern Fringe must have had similar roots, and that the cultists were simply drawing the tyrannids to their worlds so that they may feast, devour, and destroy. But Icar IV could not fall to this fate, and so, with a renewed sense of urgency, he transmitted an astropathic distress call to the Imperium, demanding immediate military intervention to quell this disgusting cult. The Ultramarines, situated relatively closely to Icar IV, accepted his summons and assembled a fleet, ready to do battle with the Tyranids once more and to crush what they knew to be the return of that most terrible foe. But it would not be for many weeks until they arrived, and in that time the Hive fleet was free to continue stretching its tendrils and to consume all life unfortunate enough to be caught in their path. By this point, the wider Imperium was forced to admit that somehow the Tyranids had indeed returned, and with them brought about the dawning of the Second Tyrannic War. The Lords had spent so much time bickering over the possibility of a renewed Xenos invasion. And indeed, they had diverted many resources to fortify those distant worlds. But as time would soon tell, These efforts would prove to fall short in the face of the alien. They had piled countless regiments of guardsmen upon their planets, but against an endless swarm, they would be but gnats against a storm, destined to be torn apart upon the field and consumed within a digestion pool. Some of the early reports of these Tyranids falsely identified them as behemoth, ignorantly assuming that they were a splinter of that original invasive force. The Inquisitors of the Ordo Xenos, however, noted how markedly different they were, not only in their new coloration, but also from their sinister tactics, and even from the movements of their bioships. Thus, in keeping with ancient tradition, they named this hive fleet as the Kraken, equating it to the oceanic beast from Terran myth, whose many arms would emerge from the deep, only to drag a hapless vessel into the fathomless dark. In stark contrast to Behemoth's direct battering ram approach, the bioforms of the Kraken fought with a level of sophistication never thought possible for such a mindless swarm. The predators would disperse themselves through a field, encircling isolated pockets of enemy units, but there they would wait. And only once the entire army was surrounded and vulnerable would they pounce as one, overwhelming the ambushed prey in one brutal strike. High above, the hive fleet's splintered tendrils, which had spread far and wide, now began to rapidly accelerate towards their targets, gently wrapping countless worlds in its ravenous embrace. If one could view the pattern from afar, it would truly appear as though a colossal kraken had emerged from the abyss, only to unfurl its tentacles across thousands of light years, with each appendage constricting a swathe of systems, drawing them inexorably towards a central maw of destruction. Imperial forces were hastily provided with ineffectual guides on how to counter the Tyranid menace drafted up in the wake of Behemoth's defeat, but it seemed as though the swarm had evolved a great deal since those days. The arrogant commanders who studied the First War were confounded and left scrambling to reorganize their defenses against camouflaged lictors and gene stealers, constantly infiltrating their weaker flanks. Shield generators, power plants, and other vital logistical centers found deep behind friendly lines were simultaneously ravaged by tunneling organisms, gradually weakening the defenders, until they too fell prey to this new breed of predation. The creatures of the Kraken, colored in grotesque hues of pallid bone and blood-red carapace, had produced a number of bioforms never before seen, all of which had been engineered by the hive mind to exploit the weaknesses it discovered from the First War. Feasting on orc flesh had made them far larger. Devouring the sadistic marauders of the Drukhari had made them far more resilient to pain, and gnawing upon the bones of a world-eater warband had fostered a sense of bloodthirsty viciousness that simply terrified the poor Imperials. The toll on humanity was grievous, rapidly losing numerous border outposts and fortified planets, which proved woefully inadequate at their given task. Any which seemed too hard to break, however, were simply circumvented by the hive, which would ensnare the world in an occlusive tendril, isolating the defenders upon the surface until they starved and died. Recognizing the gravity of the situation, the High Lords declared for every available force within the Eastern Segmenta to converge, with numerous Space Marine chapters petitioned for their immediate aid. Among those were the Lamenters, the Scythes of the Emperor, and the Knights of Eternity, all proud chapters whose histories would soon be rewritten by the meat grinder of the Kraken. The Scythes, for instance, chose to make a defiant stand on their homeworld of Sotha, a planet which had notably survived the chaos of the Horus Heresy. But even with the defense of an entire chapter, it too was destined to fall to the Tyranids. A nefarious gene-stealer cult erupted across the surface, precipitating the full invasion fleet, which bombarded Sotha with wave after wave of mycetic spores, unleashing clutches of the alien beasts, which swept through the stunned defenders. In the end, the scythes of the Emperor were decimated, with only around a single company surviving the ordeal, forcing them to make the painful decision to abandon their home, leaving the entirety of Sotha to be reduced to mere rubble. The Lamenters, meanwhile, suffered a similarly terrible misfortune. Still condemned to their penitent crusade, they took part in the failed defense of both Malvolion and Devlin, fighting to the last, even as their cursed brothers were consumed by the Hive. Quite interestingly, upon Devlin, they encountered a unique variant of the common Ravener, a bioform now aptly named as the Red Terror. This enormous beast became infamous for striking at only the weakest of positions, infiltrating seemingly safe areas, only to slice apart dozens of victims at a time before opening its giant maw and swallowing them whole. Only around 300 of the Lamenters emerged with their lives, with their curse of ill fate proving most terrible once again. Likewise, the Knights of Eternity, another chapter that answered the call for aid, vanished into the tendrilous swarm of the Kraken and were presumed to be completely obliterated, with no survivors to tell of their tale. Still, their sacrifices were not entirely in vain. They had made the Tyranids pay for every world, and though 1,000 tendrils still stretched across the void, a number of splinters had become exhausted and now retracted back into the wider Hive. The Imperials were learning to be more flexible, forming rapid response battle groups to chase down the splinter swarms, which were surprisingly effective, even if their victories proved to be most pyrrhic. Scarcely 2 years had passed since the Kraken's arrival, but the Imperium knew that the Hive had to be halted in some decisive battle, that the Tyranids must be confronted and broken, lest its innumerable swarms continue to grind down the faltering defenses. But at this point, the complex threads of fate for both humanity and the enigmatic Eldari seemed to have intertwined, as the Tyranids were barreling towards the central fortress of Ikar IV and the great craft world of Eandon. The sole aim for a Tyranid Hive fleet is to consume. And so, when it advances through any region of the galaxy, it will never discriminate against whatever forms of biomass are discovered. Human, Tau, Orc, it really doesn't matter. It's all just as sumptuous and nourishing when it's melted down into that foul soup of constituent nutrition. But as Hive Fleet Kraken pushed deeper into the eastern fringe, they eventually crossed paths with one of the most majestic bastions of the Eldari, being of craft world Eandon, and rather tragically, the mindless aliens showed no mercy to those fleeting ancients. Eandon was, at that time, among the largest and most populous of the surviving craft worlds, being a vast, continent-sized starship carrying untold millions, perhaps even billions, of the Eldari, as well as the cherished relics of their lost empire, and of the countless souls preserved within their infinity circuit. For millennia, Eandon had drifted through the stars, preserving the culture and life of the Asuriani. But now, this proud craft world found itself squarely in the path of the great devourer. The first warning signs were delivered by a group of far-roaming rangers who had observed the strange phenomena on the edges of the galaxy, reporting of a spreading darkness in the warp and the disappearance of many an imperial world. They spoke of a cloud of death, prompting Farseer Kelman, the spiritual leader to the craft world, to summon a council where the Eldari would plan their next moves. Most unfortunately, the fleet was too vast to outrun, and so they had to make a most fateful choice. Some counseled flight as their only option, and that the craft world should boost power to its shields and make course for a webway portal, hoping that the Tyranids would be too weak to penetrate their barrier, giving them precious time to escape. Others, more militant, urged for a preemptive strike to gather Iandan's formidable navy and to meet the Tyranids in open space, thinning their numbers before they reached the craft world. Both plans had their merits, but both carried terrible risks, given the sheer size of the Kraken. A ranger named as Erilith, who had witnessed the fleet with her own eyes, broke the stalemate by making it brutally clear that nothing less than the full might of Iandan would suffice to even slow the Tyranid advance. Hiding was out of the question, whereas small attacks would simply be swallowed up. And so the only true option would be to stand together as warriors to the last. Thus, Kelman made his choice that the craft world would be fortified for the coming war. And so the die of fate was cast. Every single Eldari took up arms, with the aspect warriors emerging from their shrines, common citizens standing as guardians, and in the final hour, the Exarch designated as the young king performed his ritual and awoke the blazing avatar of the war god Kane. Hive Fleet Kraken arrived swiftly, within mere weeks of the Ranger's first warning, with the craft world enveloped by the suffocating hold of the shadow in the warp, cutting it off from the rest of the galaxy. The opening clashes between the Eldari Navy and the probing vessels initially favored Iandan, who boasted some of the finest vessels and captains of the Asuriani. But for every 100 bioships destroyed, they lost one of their own. Those ancient ships, darting with their elegant solar sails, simply could not hope to thin an endless tide. And as every subsequent wave grew larger, it didn't take long until the Navy had been whittled down to nothing, leaving the craft world open for an all-out invasion. It began with a deluge of mycetic spores, crashing and bursting against the outer shields in a spray of alien gore. But so crushing was this bombardment that the barrier eventually broke, and hell finally arrived on Iandan. The craft world interior, a place of serene gardens and ornate plazas, turned into a battlefield, with wave after wave of Tyranids pouring down the streets, overwhelming squads of guardians, saved at only the last moment by the flashing blades of banshees and the buzzing saws of scorpions. The Avatar of Kane strode at the forefront of one counterattack, a molten god of war, cleaving through the swarms, incinerating hundreds of disgusting bioforms with each strike, while crushing the larger beasts with one grasp of its bloody-handed fist. Phantom Titans, massive wraithbone war machines, dueled bio-titans amidst the growing ruins of the craft world, while beneath, the awoken Wraithguard marched tirelessly across the gore, unleashing distorted blasts from their cannons to tear holes in reality itself. But as with the Navy, the Eldari were slowly losing numbers, and they simply could not replenish their ranks, whereas the Tyranids were truly endless, channeling greater stores of biomass to fuel the deadly attack. the Avatar, leading a spear-headed attack against a commanding Hive tyrant, was tragically felled by a pack of over a dozen roaring carnifexes, dragging it down, piling on top with their claws and blades, until its iron form finally cracked and shattered. This, then, was the beginning of the end. Aspect shrines rapidly fell across the craft world as the Tyranids only increased in their furious assault, sundering ancient wraithbone structures while devouring the scant survivors who desperately fought to the bitter end. But just as all hope seemed lost, deliverance arrived in the form of one of Iyanden's exiled sons. Prince Iriel, once an admiral to Iyanden's fleets, and long estranged from his people as a corsair, had felt a disturbance and, swallowing his pride, assembled the largest corsair fleet ever seen and finally returned home. Timing his arrival at the height of another wave, he broke through the Tyranid blockade, striking like a thunderbolt from heaven, cleaving apart the tendril which held the craft world in its foul grip. Suddenly cut off from reinforcements, the splinter retracted, coiling back to the main fleet, leaving the remaining Tyranids to scramble as their connection to the hive mind slowly faded. Landing with his corsairs, Iriel dueled with the presiding hive tyrant, thrusting his spear deep within its alien heart, finally breaking the Kraken's assault on Iyanden. But this victory, as is so often the case with the Tyranids, was most assuredly hollow. Only around one-fifth of the Eldari had survived, while the craft world itself was shattered, littered with molten ruin. But, worst of all, was of the bleeding Infinity Circuit. The Tyranids had feasted upon the precious souls of the Eldari, and to make matters worse, many of the fallen were unable to be preserved in spirit stones, leaving the craft world as a barren husk, not even fit to save their dead. The survivors, numb with trauma, could do little but assess the damage, all while knowing that Iyanden could never recover from such a catastrophe. From that day on, the craft world would become known for its reliance on the remaining ghost warrior constructs, with Prince Iriel attempting to assist the surviving seers in guiding a people so bereft of hope. Still, despite the incomparable cost, they had won a great victory. This was a turning point in the Second Tyrannic War, as it marked the destruction of one of the largest tendrils to the entire hive. But unbeknownst to the Eldari, at the very same time, the Imperium was about to deliver a second and decisively killing blow to the Kraken's main swarm at Ikar IV. As Iyanden licked its wounds in the aftermath of Kraken's assault, the Imperium found itself embroiled in what would be the final and largest confrontation of the Second Tyrannic War. The Hive Fleet, though bloodied by Eldar and Astartes alike, now consolidated itself around the very world where its hidden cult had declared victory. Ikar IV, that capital of the local sector and linchpin to the Imperial defenses of the East, was still controlled by the newly emerged gene-stealer cult of the Brotherhood. But Inquisitor Agmar, at this point, had finally received his much-needed reinforcements. The Ultramarines, being situated so closely to this region, dispatched their battle barge of Octavius and deployed a strike force made up of veterans from the First Tyrannic War to purge the alien and restore order to this blasted world. The ragged loyalists rejoiced at their timely arrival, pushing out with a restored sense of vigor, relinking their scattered outposts to join with the Angels of Death. Desperate fighting between the cultists and the Imperials once more consumed the streets, but with the addition of Astarte's armor, the rebels were simply unable to hold and were forced back towards their central fortress. A group of Terminators, clad in the finest war gear of Makrag, teleported directly inside the Brotherhood's monastery, unleashing salvo after salvo of storm bolter fire, ripping apart the disgusting hybrids at every corner. But as they moved through the complex, they discovered a hidden passageway leading to a winding labyrinth of service tunnels connecting to a forgotten crypt, and then finally, opening up into an infested cave. They pushed through, effortlessly putting down scores of hybrids, only facing strong resistance when a clutch of pure strain gene stealers emerged from the dark and clawed through their Terminator armor as though it were soft butter. At the lowest level, the Ultramarines finally discovered the Patriarch, that bloated, putrid abomination rising from its throne, summoning hordes of gene stealers to fight at its side. One of the Terminators, a librarian in fact, seized his chance, and while engaged in a psychic duel with the monster, plunged his force axe into its grotesque head, killing it instantly and ultimately breaking the psionic sway over the entirety of the cult. Disorganized and disoriented, the Brotherhood fell into ruin, with the Imperial forces, still led by Inquisitor Agmar, methodically searching every single street, performing a merciless purge on any who once held an affiliation with the alien cult. With the planet now firmly back in the hands of the Imperials, Marnaeus Kalgar, Chapter Master of the Ultramarines, mustered a second fleet and, after making planetfall, set about the process of fortifying Akkar IV for the impending battle. He knew, perhaps better than anyone, that the unstoppable Tyranids could only be defeated if they ran up against an immovable object. And so perhaps this world was as good a place as any to make their final stand. For Hive Fleet Kraken, their warpath had led them to devour hundreds of worlds, amassing a bloated reservoir of succulent biomass on which to feed. But their defeat upon Iandan had cost them dearly, and the only worlds rich enough in biological matter to nourish them all lay on the far side of Ikar IV. Thus, the hive mind, that unfathomable, insatiable consciousness, coalesced its disparate swarms as though it were enraged and drawn to the psychic death cry of the Brotherhood's now deceased patriarch. Tendrils that had been ravaging other systems altered their course, and whether by design or fate, the Kraken's multifarious arms started to rejoin, forming a single colossal mass descending upon the hive world from every possible angle. Thankfully for humanity, the Ultramarines had not squandered their time, and the defenses upon Ikar IV had been built up to counter the novel tactics of the Kraken, while also addressing the notable weaknesses identified during the First War. Emplacements had been constructed throughout the hives to create choke points, thereby eliminating their strength of numbers, while subterranean tunnels were booby-trapped to counter the numerous burrowing organisms. Kalgar, remembering how his chapter had lost their first company in the polar fortresses all those years ago, was determined for this not to be yet another costly victory. But such is the life of a Marine, to be prepared to die in the defense of all mankind. As had occurred back then, the Imperial naval vessels fought ferociously in the Void War, though were ultimately routed by the sheer ferocity of the numberless swarm, which proceeded to vomit forth its torrents of spores, bringing the tyrannid clutches down to the surface. The assault was beyond anything recorded in imperial history to that point, with the Kraken deploying every living nightmare in their arsenal, in their last-ditch effort of consuming the entire world. In addition to the endless swarms, a number of new bioforms strode across the field, including the gargantuan spider-like biotitans, which had only recently been identified by the Eldari during their doomed defense of Iyanden. They scuttled through the cities, slicing apart Imperial tanks with scything limbs the size of hab blocks. Myriad weapon beasts lumbered forward as living artillery, vomiting caustic torrents to flush out the defenders, whose armor could not withstand such horrific punishment. Worst of all, however, were the creatures soon to be named as the Zoanthropes. They appeared behind the swarm, their grossly enlarged craniums levitating gently, while their decrepit and shriveled bodies drifted pathetically beneath them. The psychic beasts unleashed crackles of warp energy to atomize entire squads into dust, while spurring the lesser gaunts into a heightened fervor of alien bloodlust. It was later speculated that the Hive Mind had engineered these monsters using the genetic material of the Eldari Psykers from Iyanden, and if true, it would mean that the fleet had evolved mid-war, spawning new horrors explicitly to counter the tactics used against its swarm. The initial Tyranid onslaught saw several outer Hive clusters completely overrun, their defenders annihilated to the last, but the Imperium would not go so quietly into those insatiable jaws. Kalga's carefully laid defenses meant that as the outer bastions fell, inner redoubts would tighten their perimeters before triggering concealed explosives and raining hell down on the invaders. The cramped city layout gave rise to brutal close-quarters combat. But the tyrannic war veterans of the Ultramarines, newly armed with specialized bio-acid rounds and overcharged flamers, scoured the streets of any alien horrors. Dreadnoughts, including heroes interred from the First War, strode through the rubble, crushing lesser creatures underfoot, while hellhound tanks cleared forward lines, allowing Imperial Guard squads to rush out, bayonets affixed, and to establish makeshift barricades against the tide. Despite the heroism of the common soldiery, the presence of Marnaeus Kalgar could not be understated. Remembering his lessons from Macragg, he directed the defenses personally, moving groups of Marines across the war zone with an uncanny sense of foresight. He seemed to know exactly where the Tyranids would strike and was able to counter those attacks time and time again, slowly allowing the Imperials to whittle down their numbers without losing any strategically significant territories. But attrition was not enough, and he knew that a killing blow was all that could truly break the back of the Kraken. By this stage of the war, the Tyranids had committed the majority of its remaining forces to Ikar IV, and sensing the Predator's growing desperation, he resolved to a single bold move to decapitate the swarm by hunting down the presiding tyrant of the Swarm Lord. This was indeed the same bioform that had defeated him on Macragge all those years ago, but that bane of Ultramar would not catch him unawares again. The opportunity came during a colossal engagement in the ruins of the claustrophobic hive, where the Swarm Lord was witnessed at the head of a monstrous host. Seeing their chance, the Marines detonated a series of demolition charges, collapsing the flanking Hab blocks to its rear, suddenly isolating the Swarm Lord and its elite guardians from the main swarm. From the ruins emerged Khalgar, sided by his honor guard of tyrannic war veterans who leapt into the fray for what would be the decisive duel of the entire war. The battle was always destined to be the stuff of legends, with the Swarm Lord once again wielding its four crackling bone swords, roaring out a familiar challenge to the Ultramarine, who responded in kind and charged forth into a dance of death. Khalgar's bodyguards fell one by one, their armor scythed apart by the creature's blades, but the chaptermaster pressed on, undeterred by the abominable horror leering down to crush him. Surrounded by the blasted corpses of carnifexes and the burning hulks of smashed tanks, the Marine and Xeno's warlords crashed in a flurry of strikes, any one of which would have felled a score of lesser men. The Swarm Lord moved with the same terrifying alacrity, its four blades whirling as a crimson blur, but Khalgar, calm and resolute, had never forgotten his past encounter. And where he had once been outmaneuvered, he now held the upper hand. He anticipated every feint, every strike, and every parry. And though he took a number of grievous wounds, he saw an opportunity and grasped two of the bone swords in his power fist and shattered them into splinters. With a roar of defiance, he delivered a crushing blow to the monster's chest, caving it inwards before seizing its screaming head and pummeling it into naught but a crater of oozing blood and shattered bone. The psychic shock of the Swarm Lord's death was catastrophic for the Hive fleet, with the lesser creatures recoiling, suddenly falling to the ground, thrashing about in pain as they were violently torn from the embrace of the Hive mind. This was the opening the Imperials needed, and with a triumphant cry, they surged outwards, storming from their redoubts, purging every last Xenos from the city until, at long last, the Battle of Ikar IV had ended with an Imperial victory. The second Hive fleet to invade the galaxy had been decisively defeated, with the Kraken's remnants splintering into disorganized fragments, soon to be hunted down in rapidly drafted campaigns. But as for Ikar IV, it had not emerged unscathed. The world was left in utter ruin, its hives reduced to rubble. And so, as the ashes settled, and as the Ultramarines departed, it seemed as though they had saved the world from consumption, but that it came at the price of the world itself. Hive Fleet Kraken had been broken. In the aftermath of the war, the Imperium stood bloodied, but victorious, claiming a hard-won triumph that only a few years prior had seemed all but impossible. But, as is so often the case in such wars, the cataclysmic losses tempered any meek efforts at a celebration. The Ultramarines had suffered a further slew of casualties to the Tyranids, though thankfully it was nothing close to the losses sustained during the First Tyrannic War. But the chapter of the Knights of Eternity was gone entirely, its lasting legacy only to remain as a few lines of text in the Administratum's records and of the grim tolling of the Bell of Lost Souls. Their allies of the Scythes of the Emperor, coupled with the Lamenters, who had both responded to the call for aid, had emerged in a truly deplorable state. The few hundred Lamenters who survived the Kraken's gauntlet were graced with no honors by their brothers, as they were still seen as untrustworthy for their role in the Badab War, and still needed to earn redemption by completing their penitent crusade. The scythes of the emperor, similarly shattered, went from a proud chapter of Sotha to a nomadic band of vengeance seekers, swearing oaths to one day restore their chapter, or heroically die in the process. Ikar IV was reduced to a wasteland of death and destruction, and not a single one of the 500 million souls who once lived here could return to see home. However, rebuilding it, though difficult and though the timeline would be generations long, was indeed possible. The same, however, could not be said for the craft world of Ianden. The Eldari would never restore their drifting home, and for the foreseeable future would be entirely dependent on the remaining ghost warriors, silently carrying out their duties, while ever remembering the many dead. Inquisitorial reports compiled after the war declared that Hive Fleet Kraken had been extirpated, with its primary organisms destroyed, and its fleet scattered to the cosmic winds. They doubted that it could ever again assemble into a significant foe, and thus they declared that the Second Tyrannic War had ended in a victory. It is quite interesting, however, to consider that neither the Imperials nor the Eldari knew of the other's role in this war. If either the battle for Ianden or for Ikar IV had been won by the Tyranids, then the victorious Tendril would have surely been redirected to seize a similar victory over the other. But of course, the Imperials, even if aware of the fate of Ianden, would never give those enigmatic aliens any credit for their role, and the arrogant Eldari would never debase themselves by claiming that humanity has ever done any good for the wider galaxy. Yet, as seasoned scholars now know, the Tyranids can never be fully destroyed, so long as even a fragment of the swarm survives. Kraken, by its very nature of attacking in dispersed elements, has left behind countless splinter fleets through the eastern fringe. And though many slipped back into the darkness of the intergalactic void, they were not to disappear entirely. Over the following decades, scattered reports have trickled in from isolated worlds, besieged by aliens colored of bone and blood, striking almost at random, but always with the desire to kill and consume. This, however, would not be the end of the Tyranid menace. The Imperium was graced with only 5 short years before the Tyrannic Wars began anew, with the galactic southwest to be transformed into an unparalleled war zone by the Hive Fleet of Leviathan. But with this, my dearest friends, I do believe that we have once again come to our end. Thank you all so much for listening to this tale on the Hive Fleet of the Kraken and of the Second Tyrannic War in its entirety. I do hope that you enjoyed our time, but for now, I must once again close this chapter and leave you for another week. But as I go, know that I wish each and every one of you with a very warm goodbye.